This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The automobile changed life for everyone. But Gretchen Soren says for African Americans, the car held a particular kind of importance and promise. In the days of the Jim Crow South, or really discrimination everywhere in the country for decades, traveling for black people could be humiliating and dangerous. If you had an automobile, you could skip the bus or the train. You could come and go as you pleased. But as Soren told us, you still had to be careful.
My parents moved to New Jersey from Fayetteville, North Carolina in 1948, before I was born.
Got everything?
I think so. Do you have my suitcase?
And every year they made the trek back to visit my mother's family in Fayetteville.
Okay, perfect. Did you bring her in?
When my grandfather was dying, my mother's father, my parents were called by my aunt and they were told it was time to come home. They were making the trip from New Jersey to Fayetteville. And along the way, the car just stopped. Just stopped running. They were in Virginia, and they just didn't know what to do. They didn't want to call a tow truck. They just sat there, and they just waited. What should we do? What should we do now? And I'm sure that must have been incredibly nerve-wracking and frightening. And it's dark, and they're in Virginia, and they're two African-American people. As I dug into this research about African-Americans and travel, I realized that they were terrified. What did African-Americans do when you couldn't call a tow truck and you couldn't go to a gas station, couldn't stop at a restaurant, and you couldn't stop at a hotel? If you got stranded on the road, you were really sunk. Generally, when you were going out on the road, you planned your trip really very well. You got out maps and you got out guidebooks and newspapers, and you made sure that you planned your trip really well so that you were really making sure that you were as safe as possible. You know, but for my parents' trip home, it was a quick trip because my grandfather was so sick, so they really didn't have time to think about planning. At some point, they just decided, okay, let's try the engine again, and the engine started right up. They continued their solemn journey. My grandfather was dying, and I guess they got there too late to say goodbye. And my father always told the story because he thought there was something mystical about the story, because my grandfather apparently had died at the very moment that the car stopped working.
You say fear shaped often where they went and how they drove. And I mean, fear seemed to shape a lot of those decisions they were making.
You know, I think fear shaped the decisions, but I also think it was incredibly courageous for them to strike out on the road.
Ah, you made it!
For all of the African Americans who were traveling, the more I thought about it, it was incredibly courageous because you never knew what was going to happen.
We're so glad you're here.
Today in the program, Gretchen Soren is joining us. She's a distinguished professor at the State University of New York. Her new book is called Driving While Black. I want to ask you about the beginnings of your interest in all of this. This was about, as you've told it, it was about 20 years ago a colleague of yours said, have you heard about the Green Book? And you hadn't. Start there, if you would.
I was working on an exhibition about the African-American community in Saratoga Springs, which is a resort community in upstate New York. And a colleague of mine whose expertise was in the history of Saratoga Springs said she had seen the cover of this little guidebook called the Green Book, the Negro Motorist Green Book, and she wondered if I knew anything about it. And I said, no, I have never seen it before, but I thought, this is kind of an interesting idea, and I'd like to know more. As someone who had studied African-American history, I'd never heard about this. And so I started digging around to try and find a complete, intact Green Book. And one of my students, who was lived in Chicago, I found out that there was a Green Book at the University of Chicago Library, and I asked him if he would Xerox it for me, if he would copy it. And he copied it, and that's how I got my first Green Book. And I looked at it, and it really looks very much like a phone book. It's just a listing by state of names and addresses. There wasn't a lot of detail there about the places that one could stay, just primarily a listing by state of names and addresses. But I started digging deeper into these names and addresses, into the articles that were in the Green Book, and into the background of Victor and Alma Green. And that's how I got to the story that's in Driving While Black.
We should mention that what you are writing about, what you really focus on, isn't just the many dreadful experiences of people who experienced racism along the way, but it's about the automobile. Like, that's a key part of this. And there's this epigraph you include in the book that I wanted to ask you about, something written by Alfred Edgar Smith. And I really liked this because this is from his book, Through the Windshield. And in it, he writes, as you include in the book, good roads beckon to you and me. And I wanted to ask you about that because that's such an important part, it seems, about what this book is about, is how the American identity is so connected to the automobile.
And there have been many books written about American identity being connected to the automobile, but none written about African-American identity and the automobile.
Yeah.
And if you think about African-American identity, it is about travel. It's about forced travel, right? It starts with slavery, and it's about forced travel, and it's about mobility that is restricted. So African-Americans during the period of enslavement are restricted to plantations. People live their entire lives within 1 mile or within 2 miles of a particular plantation. And so mobility is restricted. During the Jim Crow period, mobility is restricted. And then you have the invention of the automobile. And suddenly people who get automobiles, they can go out on the road and they can travel across the country. And they can travel to Mexico and they can travel to Canada. I mean, it's a wonderful freeing object that enables people to go where they want to. So mobility is no longer restricted. So if you can think about what that means for African Americans, because now they can travel, they do, and they really want to.
What's so interesting about this part of it, I think, is for a lot of people, we all take for granted the idea that you can go from point A to point B. No one really thinks about it. The right to move about the country, considered, as you say in the book, fundamental from the founding of the country. But of course, the restrictions imposed on African Americans, that is the part that complicates all of this story. And I wanted to ask you a little bit more about that, because you say that the legal constraints on the movement of slaves, for example, began very early in the history of the country.
Yes, and one of the things that's so important about the relationship between African Americans and law enforcement is that so many police departments in the early period of our country were begun as slave catchers. The police in the community were the people that went out and caught the slaves who were running away and who were trying to get to freedom. And that relationship has lasted. That during the Jim Crow period, so many of the police in the South were involved with the Klan and were involved with enforcing segregation. And that relationship, the way we think about law enforcement is as people who were there to oppress African Americans.
Part of the story is, it seems, is the roads system. You write about how the network of freeways, the interstate highway system, brought Americans, you know, from different places, people from different backgrounds into contact with one another. And you write about this idea of space. Of course, in this story, black people came into the space of white people. And will you talk a little bit about that idea of spaces? Because this, of course, is another one of those really important parts of this story.
Yes. The story is really – there's a great deal of geography in this story and a great deal of thinking about how the space was divided. Before the automobile, if you think about it, most people stayed put.
Yeah.
Most people didn't go very far from home. Everybody stayed in their spaces and the spaces that they knew. So most people, even though there were trains and stagecoaches and obviously most people still stayed close to home. But the automobile changes that. The automobile opens up the country in ways that had never been opened up before. And when you get the interstate highway system, now you have roads that lead all the way from the East Coast to the West Coast, and people can go out and cross from one space to another.
Yeah.
Most people before the automobile lived in either white spaces, white neighborhoods, or black neighborhoods. And now, with the automobile, black people could cross into white spaces, white people could cross into black spaces. So people are coming into contact with one another more and more and opening up the country.
And you talk about the rationale for white people wanting to preserve their own space. You say that the idea was that they had to remain white as a way to protect them, but also to protect their social status. That was an important part of that, I guess.
Right. And white people viewed living in a black neighborhood or even near a black neighborhood as causing their property values to go down. Which actually wasn't true.
Yeah.
And they wanted to preserve their whiteness, preserve white supremacy. And so they kept – there were many, many communities, hundreds of what we call sundown towns in this country where African Americans couldn't even be in the town after 6 o'clock, after sundown.
You described the experience of writing the book as intensely personal. But also as a journey. I wanted to ask you about this part of the book, the part where you just tell of your own story that really illustrates a lot of the broader story.
As a historian, when I started down this road, I didn't think of this story as my story. I thought of it as the story of African American travel. I wasn't personalizing it. And the more I dug into it and the more I talked to people and much of this book is oral histories.
Yeah.
I talk to a lot of people. I talk to my hairdresser. I talk to people who in the black communities that I travel to. And I just interviewed them. And as the more I talked to them, it sounded to me like, wow, this is really my story. This is about my parents. This is about their experiences. But one of the things that I found, I interviewed people who were a part of the history of segregation, who are my parents' generation. But I also interviewed the people who were sitting in the back seat. That would be the people of my generation. And what I discovered was that the people of my parents' generation very often kept the fear and the their concerns about traveling away from their children. They didn't want their children to worry. They didn't want their children to be aware about how dangerous it was to travel. And so they kept those things away. And I always assumed that my parents were just peculiar, that they had peculiar habits, you know, that the carrying all that food, the carrying that big, heavy Coleman cooler, the fact that we never stopped when we went back to Fayetteville to visit my mother's family. We never stopped at a restaurant. We never stopped at a hotel. overnight. We drove while it was dark. We would get up in the wee hours of the morning and drive while it was dark. I always thought those were my father's peculiar habits. But then in talking to the people that I interviewed, their parents had the same peculiar habits. Mm. They carried a can, a pea can in the car. They carried blankets and pillows in case you had to sleep in the car. They carried extra water. They carried coolers full of food. And as I started to see that these were habits that were shared by hundreds and hundreds of African American families who were traveling, it seemed to me that there was a reason. It wasn't just my father's peculiar habits.
You say you couldn't have written the book without reflecting on their journey. It must have really enhanced the way you put the book together, the way you thought about it and wrote about it.
And it really made me think about the courage of the people that lived in that time period and their ability to survive. You know, the incredible taunts, the incredible humiliation that they faced on a daily basis when they or that they could face on a daily basis when they traveled in the segregated country. And, you know, even though we talk about the South being the home of Jim Crow, the North was segregated as well. Yeah. It was just segregated by custom. There weren't Jim Crow signs. There generally weren't Jim Crow signs, although there were some. It was just by custom that you knew you were not welcome in certain places. And doing this research really made me see how not only courageous, but, you know, how what a positive attitude my parents had about education, about this country, about their ability to survive these incredible this incredible humiliation.
Gretchen Soren. Her new book is Driving While Black. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
On the latest episode of Preach, I talked to the creator of a gripping documentary podcast called Growing Up Mooney. He was raised in the Unification Church, which he now calls a cult.
The story needed to be told, and through the process of telling the story, I changed as a person in a way that allowed me to grow bigger than all the terrible things that have happened to me.
The story of escaping a cult and rebuilding a life on Preach. Find it wherever you get your podcasts or at preachpod.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the book Driving While Black. It's a term that also could describe the past and present experience for African Americans who travel the country. The scholar Gretchen Soren writes about this underground network that developed for black people who set out on the road, restaurants and gas stations and travel guides. Really, though, the book is about the automobile and how it became a symbol of independence and possibility. There's so many stories of African-American travelers encountering these humiliating experiences before the automobile. The automobile comes to be seen as this element of freedom, but let's talk a little bit, as you do in the book, about what comes before that in these experiences. Like what it would be like, for example, to travel by train. There's a story you tell about a woman named Vernell Allen, which seems kind of to illustrate how just how miserable it could be or how humiliating that experience could be.
Yes, and Vernell's story, it actually has a kind of a funny ending, so I love that story. And I interviewed her quite a few years ago. She's a woman who's now in her 90s, and she told me that she was traveling with a friend to Virginia. And they're going to Virginia, and they are really hungry, and they decide that these two women are going to go. They're going to go to the dining car and get some food. Well, the dining car, of course, on the train is segregated, and they're directed into the colored section of the dining car. And she says that she's so hungry that she decides, you know what, I'm going to put up with this, and I'm going to go to the colored section. And the waiter comes over and he says, "You don't want to eat here." And they say, no, we want some eggs and we want bacon. We want the full breakfast. We're really hungry. And he says, "You don't want to eat here." If you order food, the only thing I can bring you is the food that's been scraped off of the plates of the white people, the food that they've left. And he says, I'm just going to bring you some orange juice. And he says, I'm going to make it good for you. I'm going to put some vodka in your orange juice.
What was the effect of this constant humiliation? Because this is something you write about. You talk about how it led to these feelings of kind of hopelessness and this really a kind of form of post-traumatic stress, you say.
Yes, and there's actually a lot of research that shows that high blood pressure, heart disease, that some of the really stress-related illnesses that African Americans suffer came on as a result of this constant racism that they faced on a daily basis, and the fear that they faced on a daily basis. And it's amazing. They just kept right at it, kept going back out there and deciding that they were going to get in their cars and they were going to travel, or that they were even going to take those Jim Crow buses and trains when they had to.
Let's talk about when the automobile becomes an option for African-American families. You key on a time after World War II as this time when African-American soldiers and industrial workers really started to demand equal treatment. Talk a little bit about this particular moment, because it seems like this was a time when, as you've said, they started to sort of assert their rights, assert their standing in society.
You know, African Americans have fought in every war in this country, and every time they have come home, they have said, "We have an expectation of equal rights." After World War II, I mean, I think that was really the straw that broke the camel's back. So World War II was a war fought against racism, a war fought against Hitler, and African Americans were involved even in the cleanup details in the concentration camps in Europe, and they saw what happens when racism is carried to its end, as it was by Germany, and they decided that they were not going to let go of it anymore, and they were going to make sure that this country lived up to its ideals. So when the soldiers came back, they were angry. And they were determined that they were going to seize the opportunity to force the country, to push the country toward greater civil rights, toward civil rights at all.
So the automobile, that becomes a way.
A weapon.
It's a good way to put it, isn't it? I mean, I hadn't thought of it in those terms, but explain what you mean.
Well, the civil rights movement couldn't have happened without the automobile.
Yeah.
Which is something I had never really thought about until I started digging into it. But if you have to cover an entire county, let's say you are Medgar Evers and your responsibility is to cover an entire county looking for looking at churches that have been burned or registering voters, whatever county you're dealing with or whatever state you're dealing with, how can you possibly cover an entire state without a car or even a county without a car? So the car becomes a way that civil rights workers can register voters, can educate people, can train people to pass the poll test, because many states had poll tests in order to vote. It becomes a way that they could support special health care programs. There were rolling health care programs that used vans and automobiles. And then with the Montgomery bus boycott and other boycotts throughout the country, the automobile took people to work. And it enabled people to hold on to their jobs during the boycotts without using the buses. Martin Luther King and the leaders of the Montgomery bus boycott bought a fleet of automobiles, and they used that fleet of cars to drive people to work so they didn't have to take the bus. And individual cars, people who owned cars, also drove people to work. And black cab companies drove people to work. So the combination of all of these automobiles made it possible to avoid taking the bus. And ultimately, they reduced ridership on the bus and they reduced revenue on the buses in Montgomery by 69%.
Wow. You also write about how what it was like for African Americans who might have been involved in the civil rights struggle, who would travel by airplane, and how they would arrive and you often couldn't get to a hotel. And so rental
Yes.
cars turned out to be an important part of that experience.
Absolutely. So if you flew in to whatever city, you'd be stuck
Yes.
because the contracts for the cab companies were only for white cab companies. And the white cab companies prevented the black cab companies from picking people up at the airport. So you fly in, you have no way of getting to your hotel or of getting to whatever demonstration you might be going to. And that's where the rental car becomes essential. So if you could rent a car, you could just pick up your rental car, drive to your hotel or drive to wherever you're going. And I also think it's important to talk about women here because
yeah.
the women were the ones who raised enormous amounts of money to support the civil rights movement. And they did that by opening up their homes to civil rights workers. So they provided the housing. They provided the hotel rooms, if you will, many of them. And they also provided food. And they also made food that they sold. Much of it they sold to white people who bought the food but didn't realize that that the money for the food was going into the civil rights movement.
Right.
So the women were actually operating tourist homes and guest houses in a spare bedroom, and they were also supporting the movement by providing housing for civil rights workers.
One of the things you write about also is how in some ways the automobile was a way of leveling the social playing field. I mean, you point out how Emily Post, for example, didn't really like that. She didn't like how the car would allow the lower classes to feel equal to the middle classes.
Exactly. And you could buy a fancy car, and many white folks didn't feel that African Americans should have fancy cars. They should have cars that are smaller or lower down on the social scale. But the etiquette that was required of the automobile was based on safety.
Yeah.
It wasn't based on deference. And etiquette previously was based on deference. So if an African American was walking down the street and they encountered white people walking toward them, they were supposed to step into the gutter or step into a doorway so that the white person could pass. Deference was required. On a wagon, if two wagons encountered one another drawn by horses, the African American driving the one wagon was expected to defer to the white person on the other wagon. In the automobile, those things all go away. That deference all goes away because of the speed of the automobile. It was too dangerous to require deference, even though in the very early years of the automobile, white people expected African Americans to defer to them when behind the wheel, but you couldn't really tell
yeah.
at the speed that an automobile moves who was who behind the wheel. So that deference went out the window.
You write about how African Americans had a very specific way, that very specific criteria for the kinds of cars that they were going to buy. For example, a black man driving the back roads of Mississippi, you write how he had to think long and hard about which car he was going to buy. Talk a little bit about that, because this was a really fascinating thing that hadn't occurred to me.
And it hadn't occurred to me either, but the kind of car you buy is all about identity. And if you think about it, it makes perfect sense. American Jews do not buy Fords, and they don't buy Fords because Ford was a raving anti-Semite. But African Americans bought Fords, and they bought Fords because Ford hired African Americans to work in his factories, to work in his automobile factories in Michigan. But African Americans generally preferred large, heavy cars, like Buicks and Oldsmobiles. And they preferred those cars because they were harder for a mob to turn over. You know, they were really heavy cars. They weighed a lot. And they were also – they had large trunks, and you could put all the supplies you needed in that trunk. You could put your Coleman cooler, your blankets, your pillows, extra water. Sometimes you carried extra gasoline if you didn't think you would be able to stop at a gas station. Mm. All of your gear could fit into a large, heavy car, and you felt safe, and you felt it was kind of like a rolling living room.
Right. You had that big back seat where you might have to sleep, right?
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. And if you were, especially if you were tall or had a large family, you could stretch out on those big seats and pull up your blankets and be comfortable in your car.
And speed if you had to get the hell out of there.
So I do talk about the car that Medgar Evers drives, and he chose a Rocket 88.
Yep.
Now, Medgar Evers was over 6 feet tall, and the Rocket 88 is nice and wide, and he knew that he would have to sleep in his car sometimes. But he also wanted a car that would get away. If you just touch the accelerator, the Rocket 88 takes off. And that was very important if you were trying to get away from the Klan or from somebody who was chasing you.
One of the things you mentioned by way of supplies, the supplies part was really fascinating, I have to say. And how you mentioned how one woman, Valerie, I think it was Valerie Cunningham was her name, said her father always took a potty with them when they went on trips.
Yes. Valerie Cunningham, what is interesting is that she is from Rhode Island and that she was often traveling around Boston. So, you know, this was not a Southern story. This is a Northern story. And Valerie's mother was very fair-skinned, and her father was very dark. And her father was afraid that he would be accused of driving a white woman, of having a white woman in his car. And so he used to get very nervous when they would go out on the road when Valerie was a child. He would always, she said, she remembered him always drinking a lot of water. He would carry this old mayonnaise jar and just start drinking water because he was so nervous. But they would always carry a potty in the car, some sort of a can that was used as a pecan, so they didn't have to try and stop at a gas station and ask the gas station attendant if they could use the bathroom.
Gretchen Soren is Distinguished Professor and Director of the Cooperstown Graduate Program of the State University of New York. We're talking about her new book. It's called Driving While Black. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
If you recently bought a new car, and now you're wondering what to do with the other one that's been hibernating in your garage all winter, consider donating it to KUER. We'll handle all the towing, and you could receive a tax deduction. Whether it's running or not, your old vehicle can help fuel the programs you rely on, like Morning Edition, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and Radio West. To get started, visit KUER.org/vehicle.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Gretchen Soren. We're talking about her new book called Driving While Black. And I should mention for listeners, coming up here, Soren references the use of the N-word. I want to talk about these travel guides. I mean, the Green Book is the one we'll spend some time with, but there were a lot of these travel guides. The Green Book wasn't the only one.
There were lots of these travel guides. And they really start before the Negro Motorist Green Book, and there are some that were started after the Negro Motorist Green Book, and they had different audiences, and they had they lasted for different amounts of time. The Green Book just turns out to be the one that lasts the longest, and is the one that we all know about. And I think the reason that it lasts the longest is because of their relationship with Standard Oil.
Yeah.
Victor Green, who was the publisher of the Negro Motorist Green book, and I must say Victor and Alma Green,
right.
His wife,
yeah.
were the publishers of the Negro Motorist Green book. And they developed this contract with Standard Oil. Standard Oil purchased hundreds, or I should say thousands, of their Negro Motorist Green books and circulated them at their Esso gas stations. And that's the reason that the Green Book was so successful. They also got some support from Jewish unions and from the New York City's, I believe it was the Furriers Union.
Well, you say that Victor Green based the Green Book on Jewish travel guides. That gave him an idea,
yes.
Kind of a template, I guess.
Yes. What we do know about Victor Green is that he has a very bad experience. He doesn't tell us what that experience is, but we know that he had a bad travel experience, and he was humiliated and he was frustrated, and he decided he was going to do something about it. And that's the genesis of the Green Book. And he says that he's in his very first issue in 1936. He says that he was inspired by my Jewish brethren, and American Jews. Really had to be careful when they traveled. If you called a hotel and said your name was Schwartz or Rosenberg or Greenbaum, they might say, "Oh, I'm sorry, we just rented our last room." So if you had a Jewish sounding surname, you would have trouble finding housing at a hotel. But it was also important for American Jews, especially those who were Orthodox, to be able to observe the dietary laws. And so there were advertisements and guides that told you places that you could stay where you could get kosher food. And this was the inspiration for this is one of the inspirations for the Green Book. But there are guides that are produced during the Depression and later that really get the ball started, get the ball rolling, that tell African Americans where they can stay. And these Depression-era guides were designed to get people traveling because the country's in a financial slump. The government wants to get people to go out on the road and to travel, so that'll boost the economy. And the way they do that is to produce these small little travel guides that tell you where you can stay. And the government starts by producing one small travel guide for African-American travelers.
Wow. You mentioned how church groups would create their own guides and musicians and other performers would create their own kind of guides. I mean, there were places where you could get a meal. But it was interesting, like the Green Book, you say they talked about where you could stay, hotels and gas stations, Esso, you mentioned, but also barbers and restaurants and where the YMCA was.
Yes, because if you're leaving your neighborhood, let's say you live in, like my parents, Newark, New Jersey, and you want to travel to Washington, D.C. to see the National Monuments, you have no idea what places are going to be safe and what places are going to be dangerous, and you don't know where you can take your family for a meal, and you don't know where you can stay overnight. And so all of these things were listed in the Negro Motorist Green Book. You don't even necessarily know if you can stop at a drugstore. So the Green Book starts out very small. It's in just New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, and then it gradually expands to the entire Northeast, and then the entire East Coast, and then it moves west until it gets all the way to California, and then it becomes international. Canada, Mexico, and ultimately the entire world is included. Of course, still the largest number of places are in the Northeast.
One of the things you mentioned, and I'm trying to think about whatever experience it was that Victor Green went through, but may have guided the idea that, as you say, what was distinctive about the Green Book was that it was ambitious and, as you say, high-minded, that it encouraged these travelers to use their, you know, their trips, their vacations to defeat racism. Talk a little bit about that part.
Victor Green was convinced that if only white Americans could encounter middle-class African-Americans, they would see that we're just the same, that all people were the same. And he borrowed, he borrowed a phrase from Mark Twain that appeared in The Innocents Abroad: travel is fatal to racism. And he was sure that people just needed to meet one another. He also was convinced that money made a difference, and that African Americans using their travel dollars, that gas stations and hotels and motels and restaurants would want those travel dollars. Of course, the irony is that those travel dollars were going to segregated sites, going to segregated hotels and motels and restaurants, because those were the only ones open to African Americans.
I wanted to ask you about the roadside restaurants and that experience, how they romanticized, as you say in the book, these stereotypes. They reinforced these stereotypes. There's one of these restaurants that had its beginnings here in Salt Lake City. It was called, and you'll forgive me, Coon Chicken Inn.
Oh, yes, that's right.
Yeah.
I shouldn't laugh at that.
No, it's pretty awful. But tell us a little bit about it, because it seemed to be of a kind of a larger theme that you would see in these restaurants.
I think that one of the things that was so interesting about this research was that when you went out on the road, African Americans encountered these incredibly disturbing messages. They encountered signs, road signs that said "Welcome to Klan Country." They encountered these horrible restaurant names. There was a chain called Nigger Chicken. There was a chain from Salt Lake City called the Coon Chicken Inn, and it had a menu that was a fan. And on the fan, they printed you could buy a basket of Coon Chicken or Coon Chicken fries. I mean, it was pretty dreadful, and the image of the restaurant, the logo of the restaurant, was a picture of a stereotyped African American with a bellboy's cap on.
Yeah.
And the owner of the restaurant said that there was absolutely no intention to stereotype African Americans. It had nothing to do with African Americans. But obviously it did.
Yeah.
Obviously it did. So you can imagine taking your children out, who you're trying to build, strong, confident children, and you go out on the road and you see all these stereotyped images. It must have been incredibly disturbing and disconcerting for families.
Well, you mentioned that constantly used image of the mammy. That seemed to be everywhere.
It was everywhere.
Yeah, and it just reflected this idea that African Americans they have their place, and it's the serving class. That's where they're supposed to be.
Right. African-American women in particular were expected to be in service. And it kind of desexualized women. They were – all African-American women were fat, wore headdresses, wore bandanas on their heads, and should be in the kitchen cooking.
I wanted to ask you a little bit more about what African-Americans traveling around in those days would encounter by way of demeaning and frightening imagery. We should mention the signs and just the sort of custom of sundown towns. That's another really terrible part of the story.
There were hundreds of sundown towns throughout the United States, many of them in the Midwest, but Darien, Connecticut, Sheboygan was a sundown town. Manitowoc, Wisconsin was a sundown town. There were dozens and dozens in Illinois. And a sundown town was a town where African Americans could work during the day. They could be maids. They could be gardeners. They could be in service, chauffeurs in these towns. But they had to be out of the town by 6 o'clock. There was even one sundown town that had a siren to notify them.
Wow.
it's time to get out of town. But there were signs at the entrance of these towns that let people know that they were not welcome in these towns. And many of these towns remain to this very day as all-white places because of their reputations as sundown towns or places of violence. A good example of that is Cullman, Alabama, which one of my oral history informants told me as a child he remembered the sign at the entrance to Cullman, Alabama, telling his family that it was a sundown town. And he remembered, even today, he won't go to Cullman, Alabama, because he thinks of it as a frightening place.
Wow. I do want to – I really liked the section where you wrote about W.E.B. Du Bois and his preference for driving cars and how he would go out on the road and write about African Americans who were buying cars and driving cars and that experience. Say something about that if you would.
Well, and that – one of the things that's I think so important about this book, it's not all about these terrible stories, but yeah. People loved to drive.
Yeah.
They loved to get out on the road, on the open road, and just enjoy driving. And W.E.B. Du Bois loved to drive, and he drove his own car. And he writes very often in his biography about his love of driving. But he also writes about the ability of African Americans to just kind of say, you know what, I'm not going on that Jim Crow railroad car. I'm not going on that Jim Crow bus. I'm going to enjoy my freedom in my own car. And he tells a couple of stories about people that are very comfortable riding in their cars and not having to go on the Jim Crow transportation.
Let's talk about sort of bring this around to where we are today and the current restrictions on African-American mobility, because you write how it may be less dangerous for African-Americans to drive throughout the country, but there are, of course, dangers that still exist. Talk a little bit about that, because in the book you go through some of the research that shows how law enforcement agencies throughout the country are still limiting the mobility of Black Americans.
And one of the things that I do talk about is, I guess, what African Americans call the talk. It's the talk that every African American parent has with their male child, and sometimes with their female children as well. And the talk is, if you are stopped by a police officer, you don't know if that's a good police officer or a bad police officer, or if it's a police officer who's afraid of you just because of the color of your skin. So you don't want to give them any opportunity to hurt you. You want to make sure that you don't move, that you keep your hands on the wheel, that you make sure the light is on in the car, and that you are very polite. So I think that just last week there was a young man who had stepped off of a bus. He was on a swim team with his college. He'd stepped off of a bus just to stretch his legs, and the police drove up, grabbed him, put him down on the ground, put a gun to his head, and told him if he moved, they would blow his brains out. And they did this because they were looking for somebody. And they happened to see this man, and for some reason, they decided that he must have the people on the bus as his hostages. I mean, I have no idea where that story could possibly have come from, but that it was actually sent to me by a colleague from Kenyon College, who said, "Your book just arrived in the mail, and here's a story that I heard last week." Mm. So, I think there's a real fear among many people in law enforcement of people who happen to be people of color. And there's a fear of people of color of law enforcement. And that's something that we really need to work on. There needs to be some dialogue. And there needs to be a lot more training, I think, of police officers in this country.
You mentioned Jan Miles and her what she calls her post-racial Negro Green Book.
Yes, and a lot of people have said to me, well, is there still a need for the Green Book? Is there still a need? And there have been several efforts recently to produce Green Books that address concerns that African Americans have in certain states in the United States about the way that African Americans are treated when they go out on the highways.
I wanted to finally sort of come back around to that high-minded idea of Victor and Alma Green in the Green Book. You know, this belief that travel, you know, meeting someone could change the interaction, could be a way of defeating racism. How are you reflecting on that now? What difference has travel made? What difference has the automobile really made? Still challenges, of course, but how are you looking at sort of the difference made by the American automobile and the idea of getting out there on the road?
Yeah. You know, I think the automobile has made a difference. And I think if we encounter one another, if we meet one another, we do much better. I think one of the sad things about the country is that we seem to be going in the wrong direction. I think the country is more segregated now than it's been in a long time. And we see that neighborhoods are segregated, housing is segregated, schools are segregated, and I think that's a problem. I don't think we're encountering one another the way we need to, and I think we're very much afraid. We're afraid of immigrants, but we're a nation of immigrants. You know, we're all from someplace else, or our ancestors are from someplace else. And all of a sudden, we're afraid of immigrants, and we're afraid of one another. And it's because we don't know one another. And I think that's too bad.
Gretchen Soren, thank you very much.
Thanks, Doug.
That's Gretchen Soren. She's professor and director of the Cooperstown Graduate Program at the State University of New York. Her book is Driving While Black. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. Our intern is Natu Twe, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard, by Ali Vallarta and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.